Hello, and welcome to the Architects of Destination Advocacy podcast from Destinations International, the trade association representing destination organizations around the globe, brought to you exclusively by Relic Agency as part of the Destination Marketing Podcast Network. I'm your host, Andreas Weisenborn, and welcome you for checking out our podcast. For each episode, we want to tell the story of both usual and unusual suspects in our sector's history and the key advocacy moments for them. These stories are meant to tell the tale in full, covering many of our strategic issues and opportunities our sector faces, whether it be community alignment, destination stewardship, resilience, or actions based on values. We hope you listen in and learn from your peers. With that, let's get to the show. Hello, and welcome back. This is Andreas Weisenborn, your podcast host, and I'm super excited for today's show. But before we get started, just a little bit of behind the scenes of some upcoming events for us at Destinations International. Right now, the last event for us and our planned programming is this fall at our upcoming Advocacy Summit in Bloomington, Minnesota, October 26th through the 28th. If you've been following along for the full year and seeing us speaking at other events, our podcasts, our blogs, our other content we're putting out, Advocacy Summit is going to be the culmination of it all. It is going to be an incredible event for us. We're going to be really doing some things a little bit different this year and returning some fan favorites. So one is going to be the Marketplace of Ideas. I'm not going to spoil what it is for those who haven't heard of it before, but would recommend something you don't want to miss out. In addition to a massive influence of workshops we're going to be building out throughout the entirety of the conference. As well, it's also the last CDME also TARD. That'd be part of it, the beginning of it. So if you are either trying to finish your CDME or just getting started, that will also be taught at, in Bloomington, Minnesota before Advocacy Summit. So again, all roads lead to, I'm calling it, instead of the Mall of America, the Mall of Advocacy in Bloomington, Minnesota. CDME is October 23rd through the 26th, and Advocacy Summit is October 26th through the 28th. So hopefully look forward to seeing you there. So on to the actual show itself, and actually, what really this is one of the reasons why I wanted to start this show was to tell us a tale like this. So really, and that became just talking about advocacy across our sector, across all major moments, both past and present. So with our guest today, we get to actually talk about advocacy an entire a millennial ago and how it shaped a destination's future. Now, you might know him as the chief instigator for DMO Pros and also fellow podcast host to DMOU, but today, Bill Geist has joined us to go back to the late 80s and early 90s about the right with a W for Wisconsin and the 25th anniversary of the opening of the Monona Terrace Convention Center in Madison, Wisconsin. Now, even though we do have the benefit of hindsight here, I still believe many of the discussions and activations that are of yesterday, the advocacy work is still very much relevant for today. So with that, Bill, welcome to the show.
Hey, Andreas, thank you so much. And I couldn't agree more as we look back and God, it can't be 25 years and 30 years since this whole thing really started. We look back and we say, you know, some of the tactics that we used actually are just as relevant today as they were, you know, 30 years ago. And so thanks for the opportunity to go down memory lane.
Absolutely. And that was the part, was the first question to kick it off. I mean, I, you know, was following you on LinkedIn and saw you posted, you know, that early, I think early 90s video of the referendum and get to see, you know, a nice young Bill Geist there talking about it. And what really struck me about it was not at all that, you know, the video seemed dated, but just thinking, wow, the points that he is making here and whatnot are still very much relevant today in advocacy work that many destination organizations across the globe, you know, either fighting for relevancy, trying to get a convention center space or any type of asset built, the civic engagement, all of those discussions, they were already happening then. But I wanted to kind of start off just to discuss a little bit of, you know, let's go to history here. What was Madison, Wisconsin like, you know, pre the right with the W, pre the convention center itself?
When I arrived in 1990, honestly, downtown was a ghost town after 6 p.m. I often joke that there weren't even hookers downtown because there was nobody to hook. I mean, the downtown emptied at 5:30 and it was over. There were three restaurants on the downtown Capitol Square. Half of the downtown Capitol Square, for those who know Madison as a vibrant community today, half of those storefronts were boarded up. It was dire. It was painful. And there were, you know, our two primary convention hotels were downtown, just on the Capitol Square. They were dying. A brand new Hammond's 300-room, 50,000-square-foot event center had opened just outside of town on the west side in Middleton. John Q, when asked why he built it where he built it, he says, "I want to be able to stand in my parking lot and spit into Madison," because Madison had essentially rebuffed him. He came with this project and said, "I can do a convention center for you," back in the late 80s. And Madison just said no, because they didn't like the location that he was proposing on the south side. They wanted it downtown, and he didn't want to come downtown. So there was this 5 or 6 years in the 80s of trying to figure out our convention focus and our future, and trying to pump some life back into downtown, which had just completely come apart. And there was a convention center referendum in 1989. It was not an interesting building. It was essentially your classic box with windows, pretty much in the same location as Monona Terrace on the lakefront near the Capitol. But there was just no inspiration there. And it went down 2-1 in referendum at the same time that the brand new mayor won on a 2-1 vote because he was opposed to the convention center, which then fast forward within 12 months, and he is appointing a blue ribbon task force to investigate whether or not the Frank Lloyd Wright designed Monona Terrace could be transitioned into a convention center. And people ask, how did that transition? I mean, how do you downshift that fast from being opposed to a convention center? And keep in mind, at the time when people were opposing the convention center, the number one reason was, we don't need a bunch of old men with funny hats coming into town and pinching the butts of waitresses. That was the image, right? That's what people thought of conventioneers back in the late 80s, early 90s. And so how did Mayor Soglin downshift so fast and now is supporting? The rumor is, and nobody can prove it, the rumor is both newspapers were very interested in resurrecting the Frank Lloyd Wright design building for whatever purpose, and said to this young candidate, "We'll both support you, both the conservative and the progressive newspaper will both support you if you will agree to just analyze the opportunity." That's kind of the rumor of why Paul did this. But ultimately, he puts together a 24-member Blue Ribbon Task Force to identify whether or not this works. And that was a 2-year process of feasibility studies and environmental scans and all the work that went into it. And I mean, I was just amazed at the work that this, you know, public-facing community citizen panel put into whether or not this was the right thing to do. And it was not a foregone conclusion. It really was a, you know, let's be honest with ourselves and let's figure out, does this work?
Well, let's unpack a couple things from this, because that's a great starting point. So first and foremost, let's actually explain to the audience why Franklin Lloyd Wright is so important to Madison. So as someone from Madison, you want to explain sort of why he is, his importance and his relevancy to the community?
Yeah, while Oak Park, Springfield, Illinois, other places have a lot of great Frank Lloyd Wright buildings, Madison was essentially home. Spring Green is where he had his Taliesin Studios. It's about 30 miles west of Madison. And so we've really always seen him, maybe not as a favorite son, because there are lots of stories about, you know, what a rapscallion he was, and that he, you know, welched on most of his debts and, you know, cheated on his wives. I mean, there's all these, you know, anti-Frank stories, which we had to deal with during the campaign. But he's really kind of our guy, and his architecture, his art, if you will, really flowed from the rolling hills of Wisconsin. So he's kind of our guy.
Yeah. And so your point about, you know, previously not wanting a traditional big box convention center to actually transitioning to, a Wright convention center is a very big point of distinction in terms of just architecture, feel, and hopefully community buy-in.
It was because, a year prior, we had lost 2-1 on a convention center. Yeah. So we knew that just a convention center wasn't going to win the day. We knew we had to have something that was inspirational, that people could get their head around and be proud of, and it would be a jewel in the crown of one of the most beautiful downtown capitals in the country. And people, that was got to be worth 5 or 6 percentage points in the entire vote, because people had that vision of, this is a gorgeous building that connects the Capitol to the lakefront. And so if nothing else, There's something here. And we have to also remember that back in the early 90s, Frank Lloyd Wright was really hot. And we had the ability to go out and say, hey, how many meeting planners would balk on the chance to meet in a Frank Lloyd Wright, the only Frank Lloyd Wright meeting facility in the country? And so there was that angle of marketing that probably today is not nearly as hot as it was, but he was a big deal back in the 90s.
Yeah, absolutely. So you got a little bit of brand recognition there. I want to kind of go back to a little bit of the need aspect to it. I know you very well know the need of, if you build it, they will come aspect. What did you envision was the why they saw the need for a convention? Was it simply because we are losing groups to competition? Is it because we wanted to attract new talent or new potential visitors into our community? I wondered if you could just speak a little about why Madison finally, or what you helped to battle to get the need for a convention center there.
I would say it's two-pronged. From us, from a convention and visitor bureau standpoint, from the hospitality community, yes. I mean, we were getting our ass handed to us from Green Bay to La Crosse to Eau Claire to Milwaukee. Everybody was eating our lunch when it came to meetings and conventions. Now, again, this is back in 1990 numbers, but we conservatively estimated that we were essentially forfeiting over $20 million of meeting business every single year. And frankly, we're the state capital. I mean, any association in Wisconsin should be in the state capital every other year to make sure that their pitch is happening at the capital for whatever their hot button is. And that just wasn't happening. We weren't on the rotation. We were on the rotation for really small meetings that could fit into, a 10, 20,000 square feet at a hotel. But we were just losing a lot of business. And that's one of the reasons we had three restaurants, one a McDonald's, on the downtown square. Today we have 53. And so, that's from the hospitality side. From the community side, this was one of those organic things that happened. Karen Wolf, I will never forget her, but I've lost her. And if Karen, if you're listening, please call. It's been way too long. Karen was one of the people who joined us, just a citizen who cared about her community and people would look at her when she would go out on the stump. And I always say, don't send hospitality people out or DMO people out to do the big lift of inspiring voters, because they expect us to say these things. She was a financial planner. So she had no dog in this fight other than she would go into a room and say, remember how cool downtown was when we grew up as kids? We always were downtown. It was vibrant. It was cool. It was the place to be. And it's not today. And if we build this, we can get our downtown back, because it'll come back to life. And so from a local standpoint, that was the motivation. Hospitality, it was about business.
Yeah. I mean, that's an incredible stakeholder comment there to see it that way. And I know we're going to talk about the campaign, the commission, the feasibility. I'm just sort of curious your perspective as the CEO of the time. What were your predictions thinking about, okay, we can do this easily. This could be uphill battle. I'm just sort of curious, what were your perspective as a CEO at the time looking at this? How are we going to do this?
Yeah, it made perfect sense to me. And I thought we could make the case logically to voters. And then obviously over time, we realized that Karen had the right idea and we had to go for people's hearts. But did I think we could win this? Everybody around me said no. I was brand new in town, and everybody just kind of patted me on the back and said, that's nice. Good luck. And, because this is not going to happen. And frankly, our first poll, we did a lot of polling. And our first poll probably in the first 6 months of the campaign showed 70-30 opposed.
Wow.
So we had our work cut out for us, but I guess it was just the team that kind of coalesced to become the campaign headquarters, if you will. There just was this overriding sense of possibility and that we can't lose this one. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity, and we're going to do everything we possibly can to make this happen. Did I think it was going to happen? I don't know. I was probably 50-50 on it, but I knew I had to try.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're talking about those odds there, not in your favor. So, let's actually talk about, Convention Center Building 101. What did you see as the de facto first step to get this started, to actually get hopefully buy-in to make this work?
Well, I will take you about 6 months into what it wasn't even a campaign when it started. The mayor laid this thing out. He appointed the commission to investigate. But then there was this ragtag group of people who said, we just got to start talking it up and socializing the idea and getting out there in the public and getting some good media to block the negativity that was out there from the NIMBYs and the everything sucks, you know, crew. And so, you know, we ended up getting together, and the beauty of this consortium of individuals was we had probably the number one political mind from the Democratic Party and the number one political mind from the Republican side. And they both had a love of Madison, a love of Frank Lloyd Wright, and knew that something had to be done to revitalize downtown. Now, I don't know if that could ever happen today. It saddens me. But these two guys in a room together were dangerous because they brought the best and the worst of both sides of how you get something accomplished. And they worked together to make it happen. And here's where I think we began to realize where our focus was. Maury Andrews was the former state teachers union president, the smartest political mind I have ever met, a mentor of mine who sadly we lost a year or so ago and wasn't there for the 25th anniversary. And it pains me that he was not there to celebrate with the rest of us. But what Maury said early on, and so I'm the young buck. I think one of the reasons they hired me in Madison was because I had a political background. I'd run a number of bills in Illinois when I was at the DMO there to increase funding. And so I knew my way around politics. I knew my way around the media. So I think that's why they picked me over somebody who was probably a lot more qualified to run a convention and visitors bureau. But I come in with all these great ideas and I'm punching and I'm moving and I'm trying to get people excited about, you know, what I can bring to the table. I'm the new kid in town. Nobody's listening to me. And Maury at one point said, let's do phone banks. Now, this is a full 18 months before the referendum is scheduled. And I went, phone banks? Why would we do phone banks? I mean, it's 18 months. People are going to forget what we tell them. He says, no. He goes, we're not trying to influence the vote. These phone banks are going to figure out what people are thinking so we can build our campaign. And I just went, oh my God, it's brilliant. So we got voter registration logs. So we only cared about the people who voted in the last election. And we put together phone banks in an old deserted warehouse. We had people every night phoning all these past voters. And we would ask them a question. We would say, okay, are you very much opposed, somewhat opposed, very much in favor, or somewhat in favor of Monona Terrace? It was supposed to be a one question answer. And if they gave us very much supportive or very much opposed, we would say, thank you. We would mark their record and we're done. If they're very much supportive, we're going to hit them with a postcard and communication, you know, a month out from the referendum. If they're very much opposed, the Republican side guy said, can we send them a postcard with the wrong date for the election? So we didn't do that anyway, but those people have made up their minds. The important part were the people who were in the middle. And we said one more question. We said, what gives you the biggest pause about this project? And it became really clear within a couple of days, although we did the bank for probably a month, they only cared about two things. They cared about the cost and they cared about the environment, because we were building this thing on lake bed. I mean, driving 1600 piles into lake bed to support this building that sits out over the lake. Those were the only two things that the community cared about, that voters cared about. The opposition had already come up with 13 reasons why this was a bad idea. We didn't have to deal with 11 of them. We would just swap them away and focus on the prize. And the prize was we had to assure voters that this was not going to have cost overruns, that there was no way that they would sign up for $12 on their property tax per year and it would turn into 50. And the other side was we had to guarantee them that this is not going to ruin the lake or the water supply or anything else environmental, because this is a very environmentally sensitive community. When we knew that, that really gave us the focus that we needed.
I want to get to the feasibility, the environmental stuff, but just to draw attention to the phone bank aspect here. I mean, obviously, the technology has changed from then to now, but the tactic is still the same, though. Still the act of the idea of getting the community involved, that they had a sense of their opinion, that their voice was heard and listened to, that they can actually help influence. I think that tactic is still just as much relevant today, albeit not through a phone bank and a warehouse, but the other tools we have to procure community input is still very much that is evergreen in terms of a tactic there for that.
Knowing where those pain points are was absolutely key to the win. Had we been fighting them on whether or not people would die during a traffic jam under the tunnel, under the center? I mean, come on. That was never a real thing, that people would be washed over the bike path that surrounds the center on the outside of the center during a big storm. Well, let's be clear that anybody to get wet from a storm on their bicycle, it would cause 10-foot waves to be in play. That lake probably has never seen a 2-foot wave in its life, but people, you know, they would conjure up these amazing images of disaster, which had no bearing, in fact, and we didn't have to deal with those. We would just scoff at them and go, come on, and move on to the important stuff and say, let's talk about the environmental impact statement.
Yeah, and that's the part, I think, which is such a great tactic you employed, was you, as you mentioned, you batted away the 11 other critiques here and just focused on the two, the finance and the environmental. So I know you went through a feasibility and environmental studies. We might just walk just briefly talking about what those were for you and the ammunition hopefully gave you to move forward.
The feasibility part was the interesting part, and it went faster, clearly. The clear absolute was, you're losing your lunch on a daily basis. You must do this, and it will have this impact on employment and new business starts and revitalizing downtown. And I mean, it was one of the most glowing feasibility studies possible, with the exception that it said, but do not build an attached or adjacent hotel in the first 3 years, because if you do, your existing hotels are so fragile at this moment that one of them will go down. And that really hurt us early, and it pained us, because the closest hotel is probably for those of us that were at advocacy a couple of years ago when it was brutally cold, it's a good 4 or 5 block walk to the closest hotel at the time, and probably an 6 to 8 block walk to the one that everybody wants to stay at. So, mm-hmm. You know, attached or adjacent was important to us, and to know that we couldn't do that for a few years. But then we kind of took a step back and said, you know, when we sell this, let's sell it that you've never been able to be in a Frank building, and people will come. And then when it's time for them to come back, we'll say, oh, by the way, we've got one next door. We got a hotel right here, and you're going to be okay. And we thought we could bridge those 3 years. And so we pushed on. The environmental impact statement took almost forever. Because you got Army Corps, you got DNR, you got everybody in the world. There was all the accusations that, you know, that part of the lake was honestly, sadly, for such an environmental community back in the 30s, was kind of like the city dump. People would go to the cliff and drop their garbage over into the water. So there was mercury down there. There was all kinds of crap down there. But ultimately, the Army Corps and the rest came back and said, we do not believe driving 1,600 piles is going to be a problem. In fact, it was not highly promoted, because I don't think anybody would have believed us. But the environmental impact study came back and said, this is actually going to improve the fisheries on this side of the lake. And it has.
Wow.
The fishing in that side of the lake has just exploded. And just as a quick aside, you know, why? Why would that be? Well, because our lake freezes, they have to put a very, very light electrical charge into each one of the piles, so that the water around those piles don't freeze hard and buckle the pile. So there's this little electrical charge, which apparently attracts fish. And so underneath this center has become this major spawning ground, which again, they told us this was going to happen, and we went, oh, nobody's going to believe that. So we didn't use it, but it's true. It actually happened.
Good little tip for anyone else potentially looking at building a convention center by a lake.
Right.
You get the big wins here with both the feasibility study and the environmental study. But in the background, you are still running. You still have a day job, right? You're still running a destination organization. And I think it's interesting. You're really starting to bring the voice of the Madison CVB into major civic projects and civic engagements. I just want to ask, from your perspective then and the staff at the time, did that seem natural? Did every day seem like a new experience? Because now we're seeing more, especially through the pandemic, desertization seen as an entity that can engage in conversation in civic projects. But I don't think back then there was always necessarily that connection that they need a seat at the table here.
I'm sure there were others before us, and I can think of Wayne Chapel in Baltimore trying to build his convention center. But we were really one of the first. And I don't say that with a sense of pride. I don't think we knew what we were doing at the time. We only knew that we had one shot at this, and this was our moment in time and we had to do this. And so my board, to their credit, gave me the ability to essentially go almost full time on this project. And that's, you know, for anybody listening who's thinking about going down that path, you know, be careful with your funding, because what we did was we made sure that everything I touched, from my office supplies to my phone to everything, was paid for out of membership. My salary, wow, everything was paid for out of membership and other private sector investment, because I can't be out there running on room tax or other taxes trying to affect an election, a referendum, a public policy. You can't do that. And the media came knocking a couple of times, and we had to show them how we had split not only our books, we had split banks. I was getting paid out of one bank and everything else was coming out of another one. And my staff was under direct orders, you do not even touch this project because you're running on room tax. Now, on Saturdays, if you want to be at one of the info booths at the farmer's market as a volunteer, feel free. But you know, no expectation. We want you guys over here. I'm going to be over on this side. And so, you know, I think it was one of those moments that I don't think I knew any better that this wasn't what DMOs do, right? But it was one of those things where we had to. We knew this was the difference between Madison becoming, you know, a top 10 city and Madison continuing to spiral into, you know, despair.
I mean, I want to talk about the moonshot here, but just to put a pin in about the aspect of, you know, part of being a community shared value is being a good steward of public dollars and fiduciary responsibility. So to hear you talk that length of the responsibility you held to yourself and the staff is incredibly admirable, because I think that's something that's part of the DNA of what we should all be doing, you know, as we look at public dollars. But let's talk about the moonshot and the actual referendum, the video that hopefully many of you watched, and the win. I just kind of walk through, you get to this point where now you can get to referendum. What were you thinking to hopefully say, okay, we have this in our back pocket of the feasibility, the environmental study. We know we need this. We know it's a moonshot here to get this. Just want to kind of walk us through that aspect of the referendum and ultimately the win. What was going through your thoughts and your team's thoughts and the community's thoughts possibly?
Yeah, I'll take a step back to say, because we understood the two issues that were most critical to voters and residents, we actually were able to, because the mayor was on our side and the mayor was trying to get this done and he had the authority to do this, we wrote the question, the referendum question, should we build Monona Terrace so long as it does not exceed $12 on the average property tax bill on homes in Madison, and so long as the environmental impact study, which had still not completely been done, comes back clean. So in doing so, we took the two issues off the table and said, okay, here are the two issues you're concerned about. If they didn't exist, should we build it? And we hoped the answer would be yes. And our polling showed that we would probably be at 53.4% yes with that question. Ultimately, it ended up being 50.8% of the vote. So it was it was a night at campaign headquarters of waiting for the very, very last precinct and the very, very last ward to come in, because we weren't sure. But we were pretty confident, because we knew that the votes that were yet to come in were from the west side, and the west side was leaning towards the center. The other thing that I think was a key right in the final week or so of the campaign, Maury knew that I was a bull in a china shop. And when we would go off and do debates and we'd square off on radio shows, you know, against the opponents, it was my first example of what we see today that's pervasive, which is lying without any compunction at all, that you're lying, that you're just making stuff up. And I would sit there in front of these people and they were lying. Absolutely. They knew they were lying, but they felt passionately about it. And so they thought meets the ends. And so I just wanted to attack. I mean, I was young. I was just, you know, I was bull in a china shop, and Maury kept going, Bill, back. He kept holding me back. And a week before, he calls me and he goes, go. And I said, what? He goes, take them out. Go. He goes, it's a week out. They can't mount a defense to anything you say. Just take them out at the knees. And we had a debate on live on Channel 3 that evening. And we essentially flipped the conversation and said, you know, we've been working on this with a Blue Ribbon Task Force with 3,000 supporters for 2 years, and we have a vision for Madison. What's yours? Other than no. And, you know, of course, the person's like, bah, 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 bah. And they were just toast. I'm not sure that was more than worth a percentage point, but it was fun. Anyway, we get to the election night, and it ran neck and neck all night long. It was a huge win for us when it came back at 50.8% of the vote. And I tell people that if you go downtown Madison today and you ask somebody on the street, did you vote for it? 4 out of 5 will say yes. That's how big of a success this building has become.
I mean, just that moment, 50.8%. Yeah, I mean, that's right. Remarkable to think about. I want to ask, from start to finish, from when you arrived to that referendum, just to talk about perseverance here, what was that total duration of years and months to get to that?
Yeah, so I arrived June 1st of 1990, and the referendum was the first week of November of 1992.
Wow.
So yeah, that consumed my life for a couple of years. And the perseverance thing, I got to tip a hat also to the other key individual who sadly passed a number of years ago, but was the glue that held us together. And that's a guy named George Nelson. He was the chair of the Blue Ribbon Task Force. The mayor trusted him implicitly. He had helped the last time the mayor was the mayor, because he kept coming back every few years, helped him get the Civic Center, our performing arts center, done. And so George was this kind of guy that just exuded we're going to win. And, you mm-hmm. know, we would get hit with some accusation that it's like, oh, I don't know how we get out from under this one. And he would just go, got him where we want him. This is good. This is good. Don't worry about it. And every time we thought all was lost, George was there saying, we're going to win this. We have to win this. Keep going, keep going, keep going. And he was just a force of nature that, you know, very successful business person in town. We loved sending him in to the televised debates against, you know, the anti-crew, because they were just, you know, fluffing up all kinds of these wild conspiracy theories. And George would just keep bringing it back to the facts. Kept bringing it back home. And he was amazing. He was also the guy that, as we walk out at, I don't know, 1 or 2 in the morning from the headquarters hotel of the campaign with 50.8% of the vote, he gave me a bear hug, slapped his arm around me and says, you know what I like about you, Billy? And of course, nobody calls me Billy. Now, of course, they all will after this podcast. He goes, you know what I like about you, Billy? Because you haven't been here long enough to know that we couldn't do this.
That's incredible.
That was also part of the key. I think there was probably 3 or 4 of us on the inner circle that had been in town for a couple of years. And we didn't realize how stacked the deck was against us. I mean, it was stacked. And we just didn't see that. And sometimes that's the best way to go into a fight, is not knowing that you're way outgunned.
Absolutely. I mean, we're going to obviously put the video in the show notes, but the one part of the video really doesn't discuss that I wanted to ask you is, after you get that win, the 50.8% there, what happened next? What went through your mind, your team's mind, the community's mind of that win after that referendum the next day, or even that night?
Yeah,
even?
Well, and we weren't done. I mean, winning the referendum was one thing. Putting together the financing package was the other. And we had most of the package in play. I mean, we had the city's money. We had the state's money committed, but we didn't have the county's money. And so that was the next probably 6 months of our lives, was negotiating with the county, which is primarily rural, who don't really see the impact of a meeting or convention facility on their part of the world. And why would the county put money into this? And so it was a slog for 6 months for us to make the case to those county commissioners that there was going to be an advantage for them in the long run. Not nearly as cool as I mentioned, Wayne Chappell in Baltimore. When he was running the campaign to build that one, that was a state convention center. And I think there's, 20 counties in the state, and 19 of them are rural. And so how are you going to get the state to put money into a convention center until Wayne and his crew came up with the idea that, you know, every one of these 19 counties in the state has a chicken processing plant? What do they eat at conventions? Chicken? So all y'all are going to have a lot more chickens to process and sell if we get this convention center. And of course, it passed. We didn't have that, but we tried real hard to try and make the case between, you know, even before culinary was a deal, that, hey, you know, you'll be able to do more in a rural setting if we have a vibrant downtown. And it all played out.
I mean, even you don't have, might not have chickens, but you do have compression. I mean, I think that's something most listeners know, is that especially a major convention center, that you are not just increasing the prosperity of your local community. More than likely, you are increasing the prosperity of your state or province. That the impact of an event like that, especially, you know, if they're flying in or have to stay, you know, a little bit outside the city or whatnot, you are enacting compression, which does benefit the entire region. And I think that's a major point. You know, again, we all have our scopes that sometimes is to sell and market, you know, to just the single city or destination, but be understood that our impact does punch above our weight class and does benefit a larger region. I did, you know, obviously shortly after this, I know you went on to form DMO Pros, and has been about 25 years since just the anniversary of this, but a couple years out from this, I wanted to ask, when did you sort of look back and say, okay, not only did we do something special here, but this is not only going to work, but it's going to change everything.
You know, it really did change everything. And I don't think we saw this one coming. I think the most important thing is, you know, like I said, 50% of downtown was vacant. By the time the center opened, it was almost 100% leased up. Like I said, three restaurants. Now we've got 53 restaurants. Downtown is the place to be. It's vibrant. It's active. There's that. But then the fallout, which I don't think any of us expected, a couple of things happened. So there's a power couple in Madison who, you know, they'd been very philanthropic over the years and, you know, get money here, money there, you know, Jerry and Pleasant Roland. So those of you who have young children might know Roland, or at least the word Pleasant as in Pleasant Company. When she sold Pleasant Company to Mattel and Jerry sold his company, they had a sizable nest egg. And Jerry had been so excited being part of the Blue Ribbon Task Force. And Jerry just, you could watch this man being, he was a very, very quiet, very, very subtle, but very philanthropic man. But you could just see him just get revved up and revved up and revved up through this, the Monona Terrace campaign. That's shortly after he says, you know, our civic center is great, but it's not that great. He goes, I want to build a world-class performing arts center here. And he says, I'm willing to put $50 million down to make that happen. Like, what?
Wow. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the cost estimates come in and it's going to be 100. And he looks around, he goes, anybody? Anybody? All right, I'll put 100 down. Ultimately, it came down to $200 million at the end of the day for Jerry and Pleasant. And that has also transformed downtown into now an arts and culture mecca. Not shortly thereafter, or maybe a few months before, Senator Cole from Wisconsin decided that, you know, playing at the field house for the University of Wisconsin is a pretty old building. I mean, I think it was built like in the 20s. And he says, we need a world-class arena, put $25 million down. All of a sudden, we saw, and then the county comes in and goes, oh, look shiny, because now if the city's got a convention center. And they said, we really got to get our game going here at the expo grounds. And they built a magnificent 100,000 square foot trade show floor with ancillary meeting space as well. So, you know, be careful what you wish for. Most people want a convention center. If you don't have one, we have two. So Anyway, all of this stuff happened because of Monona Terrace. Monona Terrace was that spark. It was that moment where the city put a stake in the ground, a flag in the ground, and said, we are not going to go quietly in the night. We are going to save downtown. And the minute that happens, the private sector responds. And and I think that we see that more and more, and maybe a little less today. I'll recommend a book to those who are into community building. It's called Building a Vibrant Community by Quint Studer. Quint is credited by many as the catalyst that brought downtown Pensacola back. And Quint really has kind of come to the realization in the past 5-10 years that, yeah, cities used to be the ones who drove these kinds of initiatives. He said, I think that today it's going to be the private sector that gets behind a project, and the city is the support mechanism. That cities are less and less able to be visionary and do amazing things just because of the stresses on their budgets and on, you know, their elected leaders. Every cool project is ultimately going to have opponents. And how many opponents do you want to, as a candidate for future office, accumulate? So this is not a shot in any way at city government or city officials or any government official. It's just that their hands are more and more tied than they were 30 years ago. And it really comes down to the private sector. So I think Quint, I think has an interesting pathway forward for all of us to say, let's gather the private sector to get really excited about a project and then go to the city and say, how can you help? But back then, it really was when government puts a stake in the ground, the private sector takes notice. And I mean, look what Jerry and Pleasant did. Look what Curb did at the Kohl Center. I mean, it was an amazing period of 10 or 15 years where Madison really built out. And one of the reasons why we're on top 10 lists all over the country. We made one today on Thrillist as one of the best weekend getaways. I mean, okay. It's like, we'll take it. Thank you.
Yeah. And I really want to give a, you know, before I kind of ask my final question to you, I want to put up obviously a big notice that the work just went from that win, the work didn't stop with Madison. Obviously, incredible work was done from Deb after you and now Ellie yep. there as well to continue that momentum, you know, from that win as part of it. Obviously, we're 25 years from the celebration of it, the opening of it. But I just want to ask Bill a little bit of hindsight. How now also as a resident of Madison, just as you look back at it, how do you think of that moment in your career, you know, moment as it relates to destination organizations in the sector and in a post-Wright Madison?
Yeah, I'll never say that the past 25 years of being out and being a consultant to this amazing industry hasn't been an incredible highlight and 25 years that I could never have imagined. And I thank all of my friends and our clients over the years. But Monona Terrace will always be that moment in time for me that I was part of, as I said at the outset, this ragtag group of community leaders and passionate residents that got together. And as we said at one point in the kind of the post-election analysis, I sat down with one of the publishers of the newspaper and I said, dude, I said, we've done an analysis on your coverage and it was 50-50. 50% of the stuff was pro, 50% was opposed. And I said, you do know we had 3,000 people who had signed up to help in some way, shape, or form, and they had 30 at their best. I said, why is that? And he said something that obviously rings true today. He goes, it made the story.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, it was one of those times where a group of people got together and did something that absolutely transformed a city. And I'll always take great pride in the fact that I was part of that.
Wonderful. And Bill, yes, thank you so much for coming on and telling us, like I said, this is one of the reasons why we want to do a podcast as we can talk about these moments, you know, so pivotal ones in the past and kind of walk through them. I just want to ask quickly, if people want to get a hold of you, where can they find you?
You can find us through dmopros.com, pros with a Z. Email connection is there. Call us anytime. We're always here to talk about destination development and destination organizations and the future thereof.
Wonderful. And we'll make sure, obviously, to put not only Bill's contact information, the video we referenced, and also his own podcast as well as part of it, which I highly recommend many people take a thank listen you. To some of the back catalog there. So with that, thank you again for joining myself, Andreas Weisenborn, and Bill Geist on this month's episode of The Architects of Destination Advocacy. Please make sure to subscribe within your podcast listening service to always catch the latest episode. To learn more about the work we do, please make sure to subscribe to our newsletter at destinationsinternational.org or checking out our content through the advocacy section at the website or speaking at one of our upcoming events. Thank you, and we'll talk soon.